Welcome to the Shortwave Report for December 30th, 2011. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Radio Deutsche Welle, Radio Havana Cuba, Spanish National Radio, The Voice of Russia, and NHK World Radio Japan. We'll begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. 2011 was a rough final year for several charismatic European leaders, Silvio Berlusconi, Papandreou, and Dominik Strauss-Kahn. What does this portend, and who may be the next to fall? Radio Deutsche Welle.
Well, there are quite a few powerful men who'll probably be a little grumpy this Christmas. Just to name a few who had a bad run in 2011, Italy's macho idol Berlusconi, who survived a string of scandals that were worthy of ancient Rome, was finally chased from office. Greek Prime Minister Papandreou threw in the towel over the country's epic and endless economic tragedy. And the former head of the International Monetary Fund, Dominik Strauss-Kahn, is probably having a lousy Christmas break after losing his job for allegedly raping a hotel maid. Never was the Christmas saying of three wise men bearing gifts less apt. Reason enough for me to give Vanessa Mock in Brussels a call to recap why 2011 was such a bad year for leading politicians in Europe. I started by asking her which downfall came as the biggest surprise to her.
Well, I think in a way they were all fairly remarkable and shocking in their own ways. But certainly, let's take Papandreou. People thought, this is a man, okay, he's being a bit slow on progress, a bit slow on reform. But, you know, he is doing his best to try and fulfill these demands by the EU and the IMF, despite very, very divisive conditions in Athens. And then he stuns literally the world on the eve of a G20 summit with his last-ditch call to hold a referendum, thereby capsizing rescue efforts for Greece and basically throwing the whole Eurozone into disarray. Let's move on to Berlusconi. I suppose many Italians had hoped for years that either his shenanigans with underage prostitutes or alleged kickbacks and lots of shady dealings in his various businesses would squeeze him out sooner than later. But then the downfall, when it came, my goodness, was it sudden and violent. In the matter of days, it seemed that people who had previously supported him then turned their back on him. But I think even though those two are quite important downfalls, the most spectacular has to be Dominik Strauss-Kahn, a man on the up and up, the presidency of France there for the picking, who had apparently been warned before that somebody might try and frame him for his sexual misdemeanors and who carried on regardless. And then, of course, remember those images that flew around the world's television channels, him being hauled out in front of a dock in the New York courtroom, public outcry in France, seeing the silver head, vigor of the establishment, handcuffed, riches to rag story completely.
Do you see Strauss-Kahn, or indeed any of the other men we talked about just now, making a political comeback next year?
Very unlikely. I think Dominik Strauss-Kahn, you can just see the kind of isolation now in France. More and more of his former supporters, personal friends, are shrinking away from him. Because remember, of course, this was not just the story of the chambermaid at the Sofitel. This is also other allegations. For instance, a young French writer said years ago she had already been molested. Other cases keep trickling forward. Also stories about orgies in hotels in France when he was actually still a politician there. It just keeps on coming. He is basically now relegated to the sidelines. Berlusconi, well, that's an interesting case because you just never quite know, do you, with him? I mean, he came back already from the wilderness in the past. He's dubbed the comeback kid in Italy. And in Italian politics, you just never, ever know. And if Mario Monti, the new technocratic leader of Italy, at some point loses support because of these draconian measures that he's having to push through, it could all just flip back. It's just so unpredictable in that country.
Talking of Monti, it looks like the technocrats are taking over in countries such as Italy or Greece. Is Europe's crisis killing off charismatic politicians?
Well, yes and no. I mean, charisma, certainly a very attractive quality. But, you know, if you're living in that country and you have somebody who cannot back up charisma with sheer economic sense, which unfortunately in these very serious times is what is called for, and who especially cannot rally behind them the political consensus that they need, well then unfortunately charisma has to go out of the window. I really feel that the atmosphere, the climate in Europe has changed so dramatically over the past 21 months as we've gone from worse to worse in this debt crisis. A lot of the sort of joie de vivre that there possibly was, a lot of this sort of optimism that you could sometimes feel in Europe has really been quashed. We're all looking at recession, paralysis, a real absence of real leadership. And the problem is with technocratic governments is that you're not going to get leadership from that. It has to come from elsewhere. The problem, though, is you just don't see where this is going to come from right now.
So do you think we've reached rock bottom now? Or, well, if we haven't, who's the next who will bite the dust next year?
You know, I think the French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, is in a very, very delicate position. If he does not get his way over the coming weeks with the Eurozone, if markets start betting against France as they did in the autumn, he's got an election coming up in the spring, I think it's going to be very, very difficult for him. And then, of course, longer term, we've got Angela Merkel, who at the moment is the big Trojan horse in all this. She's got elections, of course, soon. We'll just see whether she manages to weather the storm. But a lot of the feeling is that, you know, more heads will roll ere this crisis is out.
That was Vanessa Mock in Brussels.
That report was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, mediacenter.dw-world.de. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. Brazil surpassed Great Britain as the sixth largest economy in the world, according to a research group in London. A senior advisor to the U.S. Senate has proposed the elimination of state-funded U.S. programs to promote regime change in Cuba. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Brazil surpassed Great Britain as the sixth largest economy in the world, according to a study done by the Center of Economy and Business Research Institute in London. Brazil is only surpassed by the United States, China, Japan, Germany, and France. The report also predicted that Great Britain's economy will surpass that of France in 2016 and that Russia and India will rise to fourth and fifth place by 2020. The Brazilian economy grew 7.5% in 2010. Of the six largest economies, only China surpassed Brazil in growth, with an increase in the gross domestic product of 9.5% in 2011. According to the Brazilian finance minister, Guido Mantega, Brazil's economy has been boosted by foreign investment, with totally $65 billion in 2011.
A senior advisor to the U.S. Senate has proposed the elimination of state-funded U.S. programs to promote regime change in Cuba, labeling them as counterproductive. In an article published by the Miami Herald under the title Time to Clean Up U.S. Regime Change Programs in Cuba, Fulton Armstrong, advisor to the Foreign Relations Committee of the U.S. Senate, recognizes that the State Department programs for regime change in Cuba, like the other millions of dollars they have spent to topple the Cuban government, have failed even to provoke the regime. Armstrong says that the Cuba programs, designed to identify, organize, train, and mobilize Cubans to demand political change, have an especially problematic heritage, including embezzlement, mismanagement, and systemic politicization. Moreover, he underlines that an oversight committee's mandate is to ensure that taxpayers' money, about $20 million a year, but surging to $45 million in 2009, are used effectively and in a manner consistent with U.S. law. Yet the state and U.S. aid has refused to divulge even basic information about these programs, citing only a document of vague program objectives. Armstrong goes on to present Alan Gross as a pawn, not of the Cubans, but of the United States. He says that the administration's signals throughout the Gross affair have been clear. To Havana, it's been no negotiation. To Gross, tough luck. And to Americans who think our 50-year Cuba policy should be reviewed, it is don't hold your breath. Fulton Armstrong concludes that the U.S. policy should be based on what's effective at promoting U.S. national interest, peaceful, democratic, and evolutionary change, not engaging in provocations.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from 2 p.m. to 3 at 11760 and from 4 p.m. to 11 at either 6060, 6010, or 6000. Also streaming on the web from 4 to 11 p.m. at www.radiohc.cu. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Standard Time, so adjust them to your time zone. On to Spanish National Radio. Sexual discrimination has hit the headlines in both Israel and Egypt this week. Christmas Day saw huge political rallies in both Pakistan and Russia. Russian Prime Minister Putin dismissed the idea of reviewing the accusations of electoral fraud in recent elections. Spanish National Radio.
The issue of sexual discrimination in the Middle East has been in the news in recent days in two countries on different sides of the political divide. In Israel, ultra-Orthodox Jews have been demonstrating to demand strict gender segregation in the town of Beit Shemesh near Jerusalem. The demonstrators yesterday clashed with police as they tried to put up posters calling for segregation and decent clothes for women. Today, Israel's president has urged secular Israelis to rally against ultra-Orthodox Jewish extremism in what he called a fight for the soul of the nation. Shimon Peres was speaking as activists gathered to protest in Beit Shemesh against the way some ultra-Orthodox Jews treat women. The clashes started after a girl said she was afraid to walk to school in the town because ultra-Orthodox men shouted and spat at her.
Meanwhile, in Egypt, a Cairo court has ordered forced virginity tests on female detainees in military prisons to be stopped. Human rights organizations say the Egyptian military has used the practice widely as a punishment. The ruling was greeted by cheers from hundreds of activists inside the courtroom. Earlier this year, an Egyptian general acknowledged that the military had conducted such tests, saying they were used so women would not later claim they had been raped while in prison.
Pakistan's former cricketer-turned-politician Imran Khan brought at least 100,000 people onto the streets of Karachi on Christmas Day in a massive rally that increases pressure on the civilian government and cements his standing as a political force.
Mr. Khan, who has been an established politician for many years but has struggled to win votes, has seen his support increase recently as he has been riding a wave of disillusionment, particularly among the urban middle class. Tens of thousands of people rallied in central Moscow on Christmas Day in a show of anger at alleged electoral fraud. They passed a resolution not to give a single vote to Vladimir Putin at next year's presidential elections.
Protest leader Alexei Navalny told the crowd to loud applause that Russians would no longer tolerate corruption. Demonstrators say the parliamentary elections held on the 4th of December, which were won by Mr. Putin's party, were rigged. The government denies the accusation.
A spokesman for Mr. Putin later said that the majority of the population supported him, describing the protesters as a minority. But observers say Mr. Putin is looking increasingly out of touch with the Russian electorate.
Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin has again dismissed calls for a review of disputed parliamentary election results and has accused protesters of lacking clear aims. He was speaking to his supporters in the All Russia People's Front. His comments follow the latest mass protests on Saturday over the December the 4th poll, which his opponents say was rigged. Mr. Putin is the front-runner in presidential elections due in March.
The Prime Minister said he needed no tricks and would win support fairly, adding that his opponents were using the parliamentary vote to try to create instability. The outcome of the disrupted vote has galvanized opposition to the Russian leadership and has prompted a series of street protests attended by tens of thousands of people in several Russian cities. The demonstrations have been the biggest challenge yet to Mr. Putin's authority and that of President Dmitry Medvedev.
Those reports were from Spanish National Radio, heard from 4 to 5 p.m. at 5970 and podcasting at www.rtve.es/radio. Next, the voice of Russia. Under the Obama administration, a wide network of drones have been developed to carry out targeted killings of suspected terrorists and stealth surveillance around the world. This network involves dozens of secret facilities and six clandestine bases on two continents. A discussion of research from the New American Foundation, the voice of Russia.
The Obama administration's counterterrorism accomplishments are most apparent in what it has been able to dismantle, including CIA prisons and entire branches of al-Qaeda's leadership. But what the administration has assembled, hidden away from public view, may equally be consequential. In the space of 3 years, the administration has built an extensive apparatus for using drones to carry out targeted killings of suspected terrorists and stealth surveillance of other adversaries. The apparatus involves dozens of secret facilities, including two operational hubs on the East Coast, virtual Air Force cockpits in the Southwest, and clandestine bases in at least six countries on two continents.
Other commanders-in-chief have presided over wars with far higher casualty counts. However, no president has ever relied so extensively on the secret killing of individuals to advance the nation's security goals. According to the New America Foundation, a Washington-based public policy institute, President Barack Obama has authorized 193 drone strikes in Pakistan since he took office in 2009, more than four times the number of attacks that President George W. Bush authorized during his two terms.
Unmanned aircraft became part of the U.S. arsenal in the 1990s, as reconnaissance drones recorded images of terrain in the Balkans. After the September 2001 terrorist attacks, President Bush signed a directive that authorized arming the drones, called Predators, with Hellfire missiles to try to take out terrorism suspects, according to military officials. He later widened the directive to allow strikes against anyone working inside terrorist camps, not just individual suspects.
Today, according to officials, the United States is running two drone programs. The military is in charge of drones in Afghanistan, where the country is officially at war. The CIA, meanwhile, runs a drone program in Pakistan, an ally in the war in Afghanistan. The drone operations in Afghanistan are relatively straightforward, and U.S. officials routinely release information about the attacks. In Pakistan, where the CIA is running the show, the situation is different.
Jane Meyer, the New Yorker writer, who published in October 2009 one of the most penetrating stories on targeted killings by drones, said the Predators were much more than just a breakthrough in technology. They were also a new frontier, legally, politically, and morally. In an interview, she described an intricate policy behind the secrecy. It's not, technically speaking, something that can be done undercover. But when the CIA is asked directly and on the record about its role, it denies having one.
International politics play a role in that decision. The U.S. government's official denial, Mayer continued, is in large part in deference to the Zardari administration in Pakistan, which prefers to mislead the Pakistani public about its acquiescence to the U.S. drone strikes. That acquiescence was always conditional and uncomfortable between the two allies, each of whom harbors suspicions of the other. In mid-April, Pakistani officials demanded that the CIA dramatically reduce its presence in Pakistan and that drone strikes cease, according to news reports. But like so much of the U.S. operations in Pakistan, it is unclear what is actually happening there.
The rapid expansion of the drone program has blurred long-standing boundaries between the CIA and the military. Lethal operations are increasingly assembled a la carte, piecing together personnel and equipment in ways that allow the White House to toggle between separate legal authorities that govern the use of lethal force.
In Yemen, for instance, the CIA and the military's Joint Special Operations Command pursue the same adversary with nearly identical aircraft. But they alternate, taking the lead on strikes to exploit their separate authorities, and then maintain separate kill lists that overlap but don't match. CIA and military strikes this fall killed three U.S. citizens,
two of whom were suspected al-Qaeda operatives.
The convergence of military and intelligence resources has created blind spots in congressional oversight. Intelligence committees are briefed on CIA operations, and JSOC reports to armed services panels. As a result, no committee has a complete, unobstructed view. Senior Democrats barely blink at the idea that a president from their party has assembled such a highly efficient machine for the targeted killing of suspected terrorists.
It is a measure of the extent to which the drone campaign has become an awkward open secret in Washington that even those inclined to express misgivings can only allude to a program that, officially, they're not allowed to discuss. Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, chairman of the Select Committee on Intelligence, described the program with a mixture of awe and concern. Its expansion under Obama was almost inevitable, she said, because of the technology's growing sophistication.
But the pace of its development, she said, makes it hard to predict how it might come to be used. Feinstein said in an interview in which she was careful to avoid explicit confirmation that the programs exist, what this does is it takes a lot of Americans out of harm's way, without having to send in a special ops team or drop a 500-pound bomb. But I worry about how this develops. I'm worried because of what increased technology will make it capable of doing.
That report was from the Voice of Russia. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 10 at 12030, 13665, 9840, and 7250, or through their website www.english.ruvr.ru. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production costs of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. I'm grateful for any donations to help support this program, which may be sent securely through the PayPal link up on my website, like a listener in Toronto, Ontario did this week. We will conclude with NHK World Radio Japan. The governor of Fukushima Prefecture has asked that all nuclear power plants be decommissioned there. The Japanese government wants to store radiation-contaminated soil in 8 municipalities in the region, which the local citizens oppose. The Japanese government will buy up to 4,000 tons of contaminated rice. Japan is going to relax its long-standing arms export ban, paving the way for weapons exports abroad. A Chinese state-run firm has received the first contract to develop oil reserves in Afghanistan. NHK World Radio Japan.
The Fukushima governor has told the president of Tokyo Electric Power Company that the prefecture will request that all nuclear plants in Fukushima be decommissioned. Governor Yuhei Sato met with TEPCO president Toshio Nishizawa in Fukushima on Tuesday. It was their first meeting since Nishizawa assumed the president's post in June. Nishizawa said he visited the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant on Monday and instructed staff to ensure safety by keeping the reactor stable and preventing further release of radioactive substances. He added that TEPCO is expediting its compensation payments. Governor Sato explained the prefecture's intention to request all nuclear plants in Fukushima be shut down.
The government has officially requested permission to temporarily store radioactive waste soil in 8 municipalities around the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. Environment Minister Gosha Hosono on Wednesday met Governor Yuhei Sato of Fukushima Prefecture and the mayors of 8 districts of Futaba County. Hosono said Futaba County was chosen because areas exposed to over 100 millisieverts of radiation per year are concentrated there. He said this makes ordinary decontamination methods impractical. Hosono said the government will buy up or borrow land on long-term leases to build temporary storage sites. After the meeting, Governor Sato said it will be very painful for the people of Futaba County to accept the government request. He said the government should adopt great courtesy in explaining its plan to the relevant municipalities and residents. The governor said he would decide whether or not to allow the plan after listening to responses from the municipalities.
The Japanese government has decided to buy up contaminated rice from Fukushima Prefecture. Farmers in 8 districts in Fukushima Prefecture have been ordered to stop rice sales after tests last month registered more than 100 becquerels of radiation per kilogram. The Agriculture Ministry decided to buy all the rice produced in the 8 districts, as well as in any other rice, with radiation levels above, 100 becquerels per kilogram. The ministry is planning to negotiate with Tokyo Electric Power Company to shoulder the cost of the purchase. The ministry estimates that the total amount of rice will reach about 4,000 tons.
Japan's government has decided to relax its long-standing arms export ban. This would pave the way for weapons exports abroad, along with joint development and production with countries including the United States. Chief Cabinet Secretary Osamu Fujimura announced the decision on Tuesday after the government's Security Council made the approval earlier in the day. Under the new rules, Japan will be able to take part in joint development and production of defense equipment with friendly nations such as the United States. Joint development of fighter planes and other high-tech equipment would be a way to cut costs. The new rules will also allow Japan to transfer defense equipment to other countries when it's contributing to peace building and international cooperation. Japan's self-defense forces will be able to provide equipment used during UN peacekeeping operations. This will include heavy construction equipment and protective gear such as helmets and bulletproof vests. The government has made some exceptions, including the Japan-U.S. joint development and production of missile shields since 1983. The government says it will uphold its principle of being a pacifist nation, but defense equipment exports are expected to grow dramatically. Japan's defense policy will undergo a major change with the decision.
A Chinese state-run firm has become the first foreign company to make a contract to develop oil reserves in Afghanistan. China's largest oil and gas group, National Petroleum Corporation, or CNPC, and the Afghan government signed the contract in the capital, Kabul, on Wednesday. The company will develop an oil field in the northern province of Faryab with estimated deposits of 80 million barrels. The contract also calls for CNPC to build roads and other infrastructure in the area. Afghan Mines Minister Wahidullah Shahrani said that the Chinese company will build schools, hospitals, and other facilities to develop the region. CNPC is the second Chinese firm to exploit Afghanistan's natural resource reserves, following a company that had won a contract to develop a copper mine south of Kabul.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 9 to 9:30 p.m. at 6110 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Standard Time. Please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcast. You could use a shortwave radio at home, which is far simpler than you might think. However, you could use the internet. Listening globally is also quite easy there. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.